Above all, they have yet to perceive that the place occupied by mind is paramount, for nothing can be known unless mind is present as an entity in its own right. If anyone makes the assertion that mind can take direct hold of a material object or of a collection of material objects, and if matter were something quite different from mind, then he is making an assertion the magic of the mind which inextricably falls into self-contradiction. For if mind and matter do interact, then there must be a link between them, and this link can only be that they are ultimately of the same nature. If matter were not the same as mind, then the process of knowing external objects could not take place, for knowledge is a mental activity, ideas are its product, and all that we know as perception or as reflection are ideas. Knowledge is an inner psychical process, and when we know a thing we are compelled by a law of relation to know it as a thought. The ultimate act of vision is a mental one. A multitude of images may fall on the retina of a dead man, but he will see nothing. His mind is not active, and relationship can be set up. Where do the sensations really fall? Do they fall within the mind or without it? Because they occur to the mind, and because the mind cannot overstep itself, we must admit that they fall within it. An object must fall within the lenity of the same stuff as consciousness if it is to be recognized at all, which means it must first be converted into mental stuff. Therefore, an object or an experience must first be transformed into an idea before the mind can become aware of it. The five senses seem to tell us of material things, but without the mind they would be struck dumb and remain forever silent. Analysis of the process of knowing has already revealed that sight, hearing, etc., really and finally reside in the mind and nowhere else, and that what is actually brought into awareness is a mental thing. That is to say, the mind's immediate and direct knowledge is of things of its own nature, of the same character and not different from it as material things are supposed to be different. Thought and feeling are the prerogatives of mind. That which is thought or felt is therefore mental, that is idea, whether it be a wooden table, a distant star or hot anger. Nothing is perceived without being thought, hence nothing that is seen is known as being other than idea. What is the relation which exists between your perceptions and your mind? Do they exist outside of your mind? Reflection will show its impossibility. They are themselves of the very nature of mind, that is, they are conscious, invisible and immaterial. They are, therefore, composed of the same stuff as that of which the mind itself is composed. The activity of the experiencing mind generates whatever it knows. Hence consciousness, as we ordinarily know it, is a continuum of ideas and images. It is the mind that makes it possible for us to see, hear and feel, and it is seeing, hearing and feeling that make it possible for us to experience the object. Therefore, no internal idea, no external object. The common belief is that what is experienced in sensation is identical with the physical object. Actually, we do know more of the nature of the object than what it is in terms of sensation, that is idea. The unreflecting attitude of a common sense view of the world takes what is seen for a truism. It knows little of the process of perception whereby that world of what are said to be physical things becomes known. It does not know that the world is never directly apprehended and consequently never really gets within our experience. The mind actually takes hold of something related, some sensation, percept, image or picture which is essentially mental. It becomes aware of what is akin to it, which means that it may know ideas, but nothing else. It sees finally that which represents itself in consciousness rather than that which represents itself to the senses. The known is not less mental than the knowing element itself. The mind thus fulfills a double office. It is both awareness and the idea of which it is aware. Its nature is such that it becomes directly conscious of nothing that extends beyond itself but only of the changes within itself, that is of thoughts. To make the mind the passive recipient of impressions from an alien world is to ignore the fact that mind knows only mental things, that is ideas. Whether an outward thing gives birth to sensation or not, it can still only be an idea in itself if it is to be apprehended. A whole train of false interpretations and futile questions disappears when this truth is seen. Mind does not depend on any external thing for its awareness of that thing, because there is nothing that is external or internal to mind. The thing must be present to mind as an idea and can be immediately present in no other way. Thoughts, indeed, are all that it possesses, all that it experiences, whether they be thoughts of hearing something or seeing something. It is not the five physical senses which finally feel the pleasure of a summer's garden walk or the pain of a winter's icy exposure, but the immaterial mind. It is not the visible fleshly eye which really reads the words imprinted upon this page, but the invisible mind. The truth of this fundamental fact of existence is as scientific as it is philosophic, and will become an accepted axiom of college textbooks before the troubled sands of this century have run out. The primacy of thoughts. We must now gather up whatever insight into our external experience of things we have gained. When we first picked up our fountain pen, we started with the physical notion that but for the light rays we could never have seen it. We went on to the anatomical notion that but for the eyes we could not, the magic of the mind, have seen the light rays. We proceeded to the physiological notions that but for the nerves the eyes would have seen nothing, and but for the brain the nerves would have experienced their vibrations in vain. Then we rose to the psychological notion that here, at this point, the mind began its constructive work, and that but for the latter we should still have failed to see the pen, for we become aware of it finally as a thought, the instant of conscious perception being the instant of actual experience of the pen's existence. But we noted that there was no ascertainable connection at the point of transition from the physical brain to the non-physical sensations, so that the continuity of the whole process was broken. In searching for an explanation of this break, we made the startling discovery that because the mental image of the pen was the first intimation we had of its existence, and because the only things perceptible to mind were such images, such thoughts, then it must have constructed the idea of the pen before it could have known that the pen existed. We began by making mind, light, eye, nerve and brain partners in this game of getting experience of the pen. We have ended by finding not only that mind alone underwent the experience, but that it also produced the idea which constituted its experience. What does this mean? It means that we have begun by knowing there is a pen. But in making an analysis of how we came to this knowledge, this thought, we return to our starting point, the same thought. We have been traveling in a perfect circle. This implies that at no point of the circle have we touched the object other than as a thought. Stranger still, it further implies that we have been traveling within the realm of thoughts throughout. We have only succeeded in passing from one mental construct to another. This last conclusion is strange, because it compels us to place within the mental circle not only the brain but the nerves, and not only the nerves but the eyes, and not only the eyes but the light. Then what of the actual pen itself? Let us put that question aside for a brief while and concentrate on this astonishing state of affairs in which we have somehow got involved. For the sum of all these statements is that in moving from light ray to physical brain we have merely moved from one thought, one percept, to another at every separate stage of the journey. What takes place in the eyes, in the nerves, and in the brain we can learn only from what we can observe therein, that is from sensations formed into percepts and from what we can infer from such observations, that is from inferences. But both sensations and inferences are thoughts. Unless we have the intellectual courage to come to this conclusion, we shall make the serious blunder of treating one group of sensations, that is the percept of the reflected light image of the pen, as mental, but treating another group of sensations, that is the percept of our bodily sensory system, as non-mental. The two realms of observations are identical insofar as they are both objectively experienced and both physically seen. Both light ray and fleshly body stand on precisely the same footing. We must be consistent, therefore. What is valid for the lit and colored image of the pen formed by the light rays is equally valid for the lit and colored images of the eyes themselves, of the nerves and of the brain. We know all these things because they are thinkable things, because they are known in the last analysis as ideas. Therefore we have no alternative but to make the whole system of eyes, nerves and brain a system of ideas. Science has never been able to demonstrate how objective sense impression and subjective idea can coalesce. This is because it has artificially divided that which forms an indivisible union. It has severed in theory what has never been severed in reality. The question involved in the problem of the physiologist's gap is unanswerable because it is unescapable. The broken continuity of explanation can only be maintained if he has the boldness to throw the whole nervous system, the entire body and the external object into unity with the sensation itself, that is to deprive them of their material character and convert them all into ideas. He must take up the view that their place in the sensory circuit is as mental as is the idea in which this circuit ends. Otherwise the process of knowing the varied things of this world becomes unaccountable and must ever remain an insoluble mystery. Both the initial and the ultimate acts in sensation are thus seen to be acts of mind. All that occurs between them occurs within mind. Similarly, the initial and ultimate substance dealt with is also mind. Where then is room for a material structure of eyes, nerves and brain? They must be mental constructs too, for neither nerve nor brain nor eye can sufficiently account for the formation of a perception if they are to be taken as non-mental things. Their very nature offers intrinsic obstacles to the building of a bridge between the conscious act of perception and the supposedly unconscious materials which are worked up into the act. Science has not succeeded in overcoming these obstacles, and it is impossible to conceive that it can ever do so. Physiology can minutely describe these materials and the way they are arranged, but it cannot do more. For the final perception is a mental affair and hence beyond its boundary. The magic of the mind solution is to recognize that mind is present and active throughout. The hidden teaching disturbs none of the scientific facts about sensation and perception already narrated. On the contrary, it allows for them. What it does is to complete them by casting a bridge across the enormous chasm left by them. It explains that the entire structure of eyes, nerves and brain falls inside mind and has never existed outside it, which means that we are dealing with ideas all the time when we believe we are dealing with non-mental material substances fashioned in the forms of eye, nerve and brain. The reason why we are not aware of this is that we circumscribe the mind within a small space inside the head and therefore have no option but to place the sensory and nervous structure outside mind. We forget that the entire body itself is but a complex of mental percepts. All the delicate physiological apparatus which manufactures impressions, all the marvelously responsive eyes, nose, ears, skin and tongue, all the network of complicated nerves and winding convolutions of the brain which belong to the physical body and which are taken to be solid material things, are themselves enclosed within the charmed circle of consciousness, are only mentally known. They must be in short nothing more and nothing less than mental constructs. What exclamation mark it will be objected, are we to regard our awareness of a person standing before us as being merely the awareness of a group of ideas? The reply is that both touch and sight and all the senses are mental, that beyond these sensations which tell us of head, trunk, legs and arms and which ultimately resolve themselves into conscious states, we know for certain of nothing. Our consciousness and its states exist with a surety which is irrefutable, but the materiality of the other person's body exists only as an idea. The whole content of his being is identical for us with our conscious states. He is not and he cannot be extramental. He cannot be independent of our consciousness. Once we abandon the futile attempt to regard sense impressions of the human body, whether of our own or of another's, as being material activities and take them for what they are, purely mental, the picture of our universe becomes clearer and the puzzles which beset the materialist view disappear altogether. Nothing else will perfectly answer our question and nothing less will profoundly satisfy our reason. Thus our ultimate awareness of the existence of all these sensory nerves and sensory organs is itself an act of perception. If we have had to end with the mind, it may dawn on us that we unconsciously began with mind too. We have been traveling in a circle and never really got away from mind at any moment. The terms brain, nerve and sense instrument are indeed merely terms used by the mind to describe its own experiences. They are themselves perceived objects. The whole of man's physical body is nothing less than a percept, for we become aware of it because we see parts of it and feel its surface, etc., all of which are simply internal sensations. Finally, it may be suggested to those who find difficulty in grasping these admittedly difficult points that a helpful illustration is to consider the dream experience of dream bodies. So long as men come to premature unreflected conclusions about this familiar act of experiencing an external thing, which recurs continuously throughout their waking lives, so long will they be unable to comprehend its vital and immense importance as one key to the right understanding of life's mystery. Let it be emphasized that what is written in this chapter is not written from the practical standpoint of everyday living but from the subtler standpoint of what is ultimately true. Our criterion of truth is not to be what the lined palm of one's hand feels, which is satisfactory enough to the plain man, but what the reasoning and judging power of the mind ascertains, which is alone satisfactory to the philosopher. Nobody will ever be able to dislodge reason from this central fact of mentalism, do what he will. What are things? It is now time to face one of our final problems. What becomes of the independent externally experienced thing which has somehow been left out of this reckoning whilst we were so preoccupied with ascertaining how we formed our idea of it? We seem to ourselves to have entered into close intercourse with those external objects, but we now know that we never enter more than intercourse with ideas. We seem to have immediate experience of the material things, but it is wholly impossible to prove their immediate presence in our experience. We can testify only to the experience of pictures in the mind and to the fact that the independently existing object has never really been revealed to our senses. We have only thought of it, just as we have thought of the senses themselves. We can make no truthful statement about it for the simple reason that our experience is completely cut off from it. We cannot place ourselves beside it. Must we then bow our head humbly and admit that this mysterious thing in itself remains outside the other end of the eye magic of the mind-nerve-brain series, apparently an unknown and ever unknowable object? We accept the existence of things because we perceive them. Let us look into the point. It is necessary to examine this act of perception more closely. We take it habitually for granted when we attend to sensations and perceptions that we are attending to carrot material things and that we are receiving information about objects which exist quite separately from ourselves. The philosopher cannot afford to take anything for granted, however. He endeavors through the profoundest possible reflection to enter into an understanding of what is actually occurring, rejecting all assumptions and inferences in the process. First of all, we must make it clear beyond doubt that the very moment of sensing the existence of a fountain pen is an act of mind, consciousness, and no longer an act of nerve vibration or cerebral change, that it is not a physical process at all. The physiological account of sensation accounts for everything except for this first moment of awareness when the pen becomes known to us. It does not account for the birth of consciousness of the pen, for the mental act of knowing it as apart from the supposedly physical act of entering into relation with it. Moreover, the mere act of judging the impressions of objects is itself a mental activity which cannot be explained by any physical process. Thus, instead of separating percept from object, we ought to separate the awareness of perception from the percept itself, both being mental. And instead of separating the subjective from the objective, we would do better to separate consciousness from the object of consciousness, that is idea. When we examine this verbal symbol idea, we find it to be an expression of an awareness which is immediate, innate, direct and obvious, whereas that of things is indirect, added and interpreted, in short, inferred. It is because we see the mental image of a separate independent external material man that we automatically and unconsciously think that there is also a person to whom that image corresponds. Nevertheless, such is the relativity of thought that the very presence of an idea forces us to prejudge the issue and think that there is a material thing outside which has given birth to the idea. The percept of a man is alone directly known. Any other must be a mentally constructed one. The awareness of sensations is certain and indubitable. The knowledge of an external cause of those sensations to which they answer is entirely inferred and supposed. We see, taste and feel external things as being absolutely independent merely because we start with an inborn belief that they are absolutely independent. If U and B are in causal relation, then U always comes first. Cause precedes effect. Now what do we experience first of the external objects? Why, we become aware of the mental impression of them, and nothing else at any time. Hence, if the mental impression comes first, it must be the cause. To make the external object the cause of the internal sensation is equal to making sensation the cause of sensation, that is to beg the question and to attempt what is impossible and inconceivable. We must emphasize what will appear only from acute analytic reflection, namely, that mental experience precedes physical experience and that the latter follows the former merely because it is a subsequent inference. The image is antecedent to the inference that the object exists. We unconsciously and almost instantaneously decide that the object is outside after we have perceived the image. It is a later act. But granting that the knowledge of the independently existent object comes second after the knowledge of the percept, how is it proved that it is only an inference? The answer is that everything that cannot be immediately known, everything that cannot be known as it is in itself, must necessarily be brought to our knowledge by the working of imagination. We must represent it to ourselves through the image-making faculty of mind. And to know what particular image to construct, we have to pass through the corridor of subconscious reasoning until we come to final conclusion, which could only be an inference even if it were a right inference, which it is not. The thought is primary, whereas the thing is secondary. The idea is factual, whereas the object is inferential. Before the mind reveals the perception to itself, there is no knowledge of any external object. Such an object appears subsequently on the scene, until then nothing can be said of it. It is this important distinction which forms the very foundation of mentalism. And this distinction is not the fanciful speculation of imaginative metaphysics, it is slowly beginning to be the factual finding of leaders like Eddington and Jeans, who are in the front ranks of modern science. The meaning of this distinction is that the object veritably depends for its existence on the idea of it, not the idea on the object. Nobody can prove that it possesses any independent existence. Mind is its basis and upholder. It is a mental derivative. We may find enough courage to face the truth about these external objects. For we found in our study of illusions that the capacity of an illusion to deceive us disappeared after we took the magic of the mind's trouble to inquire into it, even though the existence of the illusion remained. Similarly, the external objects of now, after we have taken the trouble to inquire into them, turned out to be inferred, although they continue to remain in experience. Now an inference is an imagination, that is an idea. So our external object turns out to be an idea just as much as our actual experience of it is an idea. When analyzed, it also turns out to be a thought. What does this mean? As an illusion, the mind creates an object of its own and then proceeds to assume its reality. So in the case of ordinary everyday experience, the mind has created an external thing and then assumed its existence. And as in illusion, the assumed thing was indubitably and repeatedly seen, so here too the inferred object is also plainly and persistently seen. That a percept is an item of consciousness is indubitable, that the object is outside it is merely an idea. The first is fact, but the second is unproved and unprovable. An independent object is never seen separately but only inferred psychologically. We may pay it the utmost attention and give it our alertest awareness, but we will never detect it apart from the idea. For its very existence rests on inferences and involves assumptions. But truth does not deal in inferences. It must keep its feet on firm ground, fact verified and ascertained. Whoever has been impatient at this venture into seeming abstractions has erred. For until he has formed a correct idea of how we come to know the external world of things which rest or move in space, he cannot penetrate to its reality. Until he has analyzed the content of world consciousness, he cannot understand how it has been built up. We habitually consider the wall that confronts us as standing quite aloof from our sensation of its existence. We hold unreflectingly to the view that we see the wall first and then make a representative image of its appearance in the mind. The wall falls into first place and the mental picture into second place in the order of our supposed awareness of it. We have already found how little this is correct. We shall now arrive at the right view, and it will sap the foundations of our age-long human certitude about the nature of the world, the position of the body and the dimension of the mind. How can we continue to take it for granted that although we cannot directly know the object, our idea of it is an image which duplicates it more or less satisfactorily, a kind of photograph made on the mind by the object? How can this belief continue to stand in face of all that we have discovered by our prying analysis? How can it be that the object is really there outside us and the perception of it is only a copy of it, albeit a mental one? How can it be that our superficial apprehension of a material universe is correct, is just as it seems to be, and is in no need of analysis? For all our facts show that we have unconsciously begun with the idea of the object and consciously ended with it, and that perception is a psychological act, and that the perception of a fountain pen is not merely seeing the mental copy of a pen but literally seeing the pen itself, because it is identical with the mental percept and not merely related to it. The theory that although it is true that we know only our mental constructs, nevertheless these constructs are only copies, representations, of some unknown external material object, is utterly invalid. For the object is itself part of the construct and no justification exists for separating it from the totality of perception other than the justification of ancient and habitual prejudice. Those who believe in the mental copy theory, who put idea and object at different ends of the same pole, are joining together complete incompatibles. Material things are not only just as much mental as their so-called subjective perceptions but are intrinsically the same. It would be a gross error to believe that a perception is a mere mental copy of a material object. The latter itself is as subjective as the former. Both the supposed material thing and the conscious registration of it are mental constructions and nothing else. The notion that the construct itself conforms to the material thing is pure supposition. The idea of a wall is all that we know for certain because it is all that we really experience. The rest is but unconscious deduction and automatic erroneous judgment. For our entire attention is directed towards the externalized wall and not towards the awareness of what is actually taking place during its perception. Hence simple and superficial persons fall into easy error by taking this idea for an external thing. The idea, the mental copy which is supposed to have come into existence in consequence of the presence of the material wall is the first thing we really know, whereas the matter is the second thing. But it has not the advantage of being known, it is only inferred and remote, and as an inference it is only a copy of the first idea, that is we have multiplied the construct itself. We can get along quite well without such multiplication. The lesson is that we must give preference and allow priority to the perception itself rather than to the object of perception, because we must mark out a strict boundary line between what is actually perceived and what is merely inferred. The magic of the mind. But we are not yet done with our critic. He IAA very properly asks, if there is nothing external, no independent thing at all, then the question will inevitably arise, why do we get the idea of an object when there is apparently nothing to cause it? This and other criticisms and objections which can be made and are likely to be made against mentalism must regrettably be left for further consideration when the doctrine is more adequately explained and finally proved in the succeeding volume of this work. They are linked together with more advanced problems. For unless the nature of mind, the mystery of sleep, the meaning of dream, the secret of the J, and the significance of creation are thoroughly understood, the conviction of mentalism's truth cannot be finally clinched, nor can its own tremendous contribution be brought into relation with our common life. Philosophy in general has hitherto offered many questions but few final solutions, whereas the hidden teaching offers a complete key to the understanding of the all. Let it be noted that it touches on these tantalizing mysteries only to solve them, but that solution belongs to the more advanced tenets and can only be grasped after the difficult preparatory studies have been made, and may not be separated without causing bewilderment arising from the strange facts that to be revealed. Such is the regrettable position, and there we must perforce leave it for the present. Meanwhile, In reply to the questions, why does the independent object contribute to our sensation of sight, smell and touch, and why does it induce those sensations by its mere presence? We may now say that because the percept manufactured out of such sensations is the object itself, the questions collapse as unescapable. Thing and thought are identical.